is I'm going to walk you through this rather complicated diagram I drew on the board, which I don't think you'll be able to understand unless I explain it. And this is just a kind of commentary or elaboration on this following statement by Srila Prabhupada from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canon 6, Chapter 10, Verse 11, purport. Quote, "Therefore, Sri Ramanuja Swami, in his book Vedanta Tattva Sar, has described that this merging of the soul means that after separating himself from the material body made of eight elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, false ego, mind, and intelligence, the individual soul engages himself in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his eternal form. The material cause of the material elements absorbs the material body and the spiritual soul assumes its original position." So, there's a great deal of information condensed in those few sentences from Srila Prabhupada, and so this, what you see on the board, is a kind of an expansion of what you've just heard. And it expands as the form of psychology, bhakti psychology, that is taught by Srila Ramanujacharya, who Srila Prabhupada is referring to in that purport. And this basic system of psychology is acknowledged by all schools of Vaishnavas. There's no... the Gaudiya Vaishnavas or the Vaishnavas of the Nimbarka school or Madhva school have no objection, no contention with this basic, let's say, layout of the functions of the mind and how Bhakti Yoga brings perfection to our consciousness in terms of the scheme of the mind and its different aspects, which I shall just now begin to explain. All right. So we start with this triangle here. Now at the core is the Paramatma, the Supreme Lord. I don't know how many of you are still have been attending the whole course since the very beginning, but you may remember that in the introduction we cited a letter from Srila Prabhupada to Mrs. Klein, in which Prabhupada was pointing out that thinking, feeling, and willing originates with Krishna. Lord Krishna has his own thinking, feeling, and willing. So that is exactly what is being illustrated here. That the Paramatma, the Supreme Lord, is, and these are three Sanskrit terms, Gyata, the knower. It was a mistake. These two terms are actually in the wrong position. Significant. So excuse me while I correct this. There's this gap that belongs over here. So Gyata is actually a name of the Lord, which simply means he is the knower. And then up here we put Bhokta. Bhokta means he is the experiencer or the enjoyer. And then Karta, He is the doer. So these are three extremely important, extremely prominent aspects of the Lord, particularly in His Purusha Avatar manifestations that we've been talking about in the last few days, His expansions into this material world for the purpose of creation. So He's all-knowing, Sarvagya, Gyata. He knows. That's how He's defined in the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Abhigyaha means He knows everything that's happening in every corner of this creation. He is the Bhokta. He is Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that this material world is, why does it exist? It is created out of sacrifice, it is maintained by sacrifice, and it is destroyed in sacrifice. It exists as a sacrifice, and the Lord is the enjoyer of that sacrifice. So, bhokta. And this refers, again, enjoyment or feelings. So, that originates with the Lord. And then karta, He's the doer. Srishti karta, He is the creator. That's another name of Krishna. Srishti karta. The creator, the doer, literally, the doer of creation. Srishti means creation, karta means doer. So, then, the Jivatman, here I've written, this is the terminology of Ramanujacharya there. I must point out that there's certain Sanskrit terms here, which you'll run across them in our books, but they're used in a certain way according to the doctrine of Ramanujacharya. Like over here, Anubhava. So we have this term Anubhava also in our Gaudiya Vaishnava Shastras, but Anubhava is more used in the Gaudiya line to describe a very advanced, very exalted state of consciousness, ecstasy. Whereas here, in Ramanuja terminology, Anubhava simply refers to observation. Anyway, that's just a detail. So getting back to this, the Jivatman is a prakara of Brahman. That means a category. Jivatma is Brahman. The Jivatma can say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. But by that he cannot mean I am the totality of Brahman, but he is a category within Brahman. Jiva Atma, he is, or as Prabhupada would say, part and parcel, tiny part and parcel. But we belong, certainly do belong to Brahman. So Krishna is Param Brahman, and we are a category within Brahman. So just as Krishna is Gyata, Bhokta, and Karta, transcendentally speaking, so we too, encased in this Linga, Sharira, and Shtula Sharira, the gross and subtle body, we have our thinking, which in modern psychology is known as cognition. We have our thinking, which is an emanation or reflection of the Lord's Gyata, His knowing. We have our feeling, and the technical Western psychological term for that is affectation. Affectation refers to our emotional states. So we have our feeling, that is an emanation or outgrowth or reflection of the Lord's being bhokta. And then we have our willing, and there's this Western term, conation. Actually, our Shastra is called the karmendriyas, you know, the active senses like the hand. In Western psychology are called the conative senses. And our gyanendriyas, our knowledge acquiring senses like the eye and the ear, are called the cognitive senses. So cognition, conation,
affectation. Thinking, feeling, and willing. Srila Prabhupada said, these are the three phases of psychology. That's a direct quote from Srila Prabhupada. These are the three phases of psychology, and this is confirmed here. Thinking, feeling, willing. Now, take immediate note, which one is on the top? On the top is feeling, affectation. Because our emotions actually control what we think about and what we do. So this is simply a fact. And someone can try to be... You see, this is what the other yogas are about. Here you immediately see why Bhakti Yoga is the supreme yoga system. Because what does Jnana Yoga deal with? Just here. Jnana Yoga is only dealing with cognition. It's only concerned with thought, with the mental processes, how to purify thinking, how to come to clarified consciousness, undisturbed thoughts that are undisturbed by material desires, thoughts that are fixed on the absolute, meditation that is unbroken. It's only concerned with thinking. Karma Yoga, on the other hand, is only concerned with willing, what you do. You see? So therefore, in Karma Yoga, there are a very complex set of rules and regulations that you should follow in your activities. And the Karma Yogis are satisfied that, yes, today I did this according to the Shastras, and those things which I wasn't supposed to do, I didn't do, so I've had a very good day. You see? And they're not so much concerned with thinking, because they're concerned with fruit. Well, of course, they think about the fruit of the results they get from being good. That's what they think about. But otherwise, pure cognition doesn't concern them. Their cognition is very much absorbed. Their thinking is very much absorbed in material goals. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, those who are Vedavataratis, who follow the Pushpavacha, the flowery words of the Vedas, they want to go to heaven, they want nice sense gratification in the next life, they want nice birth, they want opulence. And Krishna says, Bhogaishwarya Prasakta, that those who are too much absorbed in those thoughts, they cannot get the determination that is needed to practice yoga, to fix the mind. So, meaning either this yoga, Jnana Yoga, or this yoga, Bhakti Yoga. So the problem that both the Karma Yogis and the Jnana Yogis have is they don't know what to do with feelings. They don't know what to do with emotions. The Karma Yogis, they just try to go with impure emotions, with lust, anger, greed, they try to go along with them but limit them according to, just like if we take Christianity as a kind of crude form of Karma Yoga religion, then there are 10 commandments, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt, so they try to keep their impure emotions within the bounds of restrictions, do's and don'ts. But, just take a glance at the Christian religion and you see how unsuccessful they are. And everyone is unsuccessful. The Vedic Karma Yogis also. You see one of the greatest examples in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the greatest example, I think, of a Vedic Karma Yogi in the Srimad Bhagavatam is that of Daksha, Prajapati Daksha. And look at all the trouble he had, because of having impure emotions and not being able to control them. He became envious of his son-in-law, Lord Shiva, created a big offense because of that, which resulted in great ruination for him and his associates. He ended up with the head of a goat as a result of that. Then later on also, he ended up cursing Narada Muni, becoming envious of Narada. So, you see, because they're karmis, because they want to satisfy their impure desires, Therefore, they don't take steps to purify consciousness, to purify either their thinking or their emotions. And especially the emotions just run amok. Whatever barriers they set up to try to keep the emotions in check are broken down because the emotions are too powerful. And that is so obviously seen in the case of Prajapati Daksha. The jnanis, on the other hand, they just try to negate emotions by their dry speculative process, by controlling the senses, meditation, and so on and so forth. But then there are famous examples I've forgotten the name right now, but there was that Muni who he cursed Garuda. I've forgotten his name just now. Shobari. Yeah, I think Shobari Muni. Yeah, he cursed Garuda because Garuda was bothering the. He was coming to take fish from the pond in which, or the lake in which this Muni was meditating. So the Muni warned Garuda, "Don't come here again." But then, as a result, he became agitated, seeing two fish underwater have sex, and this disturbed his mind so much that he had to leave his. Just imagine, he was such a powerful mystic yogi that he could live underwater and do his meditation underwater. Yet he could not control the emotions that were aroused by watching two fish have sex. So that's another illustration. So they also don't know what to do with the emotions. So actually, thinking and willing are both ruled by feelings, and that is why Bhakti Yoga is the topmost yoga system, because Bhakti Yoga addresses feeling or affectation, emotions. That doesn't mean, I mean, it's obvious, that doesn't mean, sometimes the jnanis especially, and even Daksha when he was rebuking Narada as a karma yogi, then he was saying, "You're not a real sadhu, I'm the real sadhu, because I follow all the rules and regulations, and you just wander around playing on your veena and chanting the names of God and preaching to people to renounce everything. What kind of sadhu are you? You're not following the actual Vedic path." And of course the jnanis, they are prone to make the mistake of thinking, well, you know, we're the ones with knowledge and you devotees, you're just sentimental. But again, these attitudes are produced out of ignorance of the fact that both thinking and willing are ruled by emotion. So if one is a devotee, as Srila Prabhupada says, citing the Chatushloki Gita, for example, in 10th chapter, verses 8 through 12, Srila Prabhupada says, a devotee must have knowledge. A devotee must have knowledge because he has surrendered to, he is serving the source of all knowledge, Krishna, who promises in Chatushloki Gita that Teshami Vanu Kampartam Mahamagyana Jamtama, that I destroy the darkness of ignorance in the hearts of Tesham. Tesham means, is specifically referring to my devotees. Who are engaged in Tesham Satpata Yuktanam Bhajatam Priti Purvakam, who are always engaged in my devotional service according to the method of love. Bhajatam, bhajan or worship, Priti Purvaka, according to the method of love, according to the method of bhakti. So Krishna clearly says that I give them knowledge. And then also in the ananya chintayanto vam yejana pari pashate tesham nityabhyuktam yogachem vahamyam. So there he speaks of, for those who are devoted to me without deviation, then I preserve what they have and I carry what they lack. That is also referring to their activities, because Prabhupada gives an example to illustrate this verse of a great devotee, I've just now forgotten the name, but he was a commentator on the Bhagavad Gita, and he was very poor, so from karma yoga standards that means he wasn't doing a good job, you see, because if you're a good karma yogi you should be getting all kinds of blessings from the demigods and you should be living in opulence, but he was living in practically in poverty. So he was writing commentary to Bhagavad Gita, and he came to this verse, Ananyas Chintayantum Mam, and he thought, why is it stated here Mam, where Krishna says, I personally care for the needs of my devotees. Well, Krishna, he's God, he has his energies to do these things. So this verse cannot have originally said Mam. So he actually crossed out Mam and he put another word. I have it written down, but I've forgotten. Put another Sanskrit word that means that indicates that the Lord does this indirectly through his energies, not directly. He doesn't have to directly become involved in taking care of his devotees. So after having done that, then it was time for him to take his bath, and after his bath, then he would come back and his wife would serve him his lunch. So he went to the river to take his bath. In the meantime, his wife was in the kitchen. She was mortified because there was nothing in the kitchen. There was nothing to cook. And she was thinking, now my husband will come back from his bath and expect something to eat, and we've got nothing. So then there was a knock at the door, and she opened the door, and there was a beautiful cowherd boy standing there. And his arms were just filled with all kinds of pots and baskets of sabjis and milk products and grains. And he said, Mother, I've come to give this to you. This is on behalf of your husband. He's very dear to me. He's my devotee. So I want him to have these nice things. So she was very happy to take them. But she noticed that there were these marks, like scratch marks, on this beautiful boy's body. And she couldn't help but ask, but who did this to you? You're such an attractive, wonderful looking boy, but who could put these scratches on your body? And the boy said, well, I'm sorry to say, Mother, that it was your husband who did that. So then she didn't know what to think about that. So she was very troubled in her mind. And she thanked the boy, he left. And then when her husband came back, he was expecting that meal would be ready, but he found his wife in the kitchen, and she was just very disturbed. And there was all these good things there, wonderful food products, but she was just kind of sitting and just wondering. And then he asked, what's the matter? And she said, she told the whole story, and she said, I just cannot understand why that boy would say, first he said, you are his devotee, you are very dear to him, and then at the same time he said, you put these marks, these scratches on his body. I can't understand, I'm confused. And then he realized that this cowherd boy was Krishna. And by scratching out Mam, he had actually put scratches on the body of the Lord. So then he himself was very embarrassed. So this is a purport that Srila Prabhupada gave to that verse in a lecture to illustrate that yes, even the material necessities which the karmis are mad after, the karma yogis are mad after, you know, they do their whole process is just aimed at garnering material acquisitions. But the devotee doesn't have to worry about that. If he's simply ananyas chintayam tumam, if he's purely engaged in the Lord's service, purely in remembering Krishna 24 hours a day, then Krishna will take care of everything, including even material necessities, personally. Yoga chema gahamyam. Personally, he will do this. So this is something that the karma yogis and the jnana yogis, generally they fail to understand. And so the point is here is that bhakti yoga in one stroke is taking care of all three departments of psychology. The feeling, the thinking, and the willing. So now we want to go around and first of all explain in a more detail what this thinking, feeling, and willing entail psychologically. So first of all, thinking or cognition, it always means subject, object, and relation between the two. And that was the whole point of that discussion we had a few weeks ago about relation. We referring to the word anyonya, relationships, one another, and the discussion of Uddhava and Lord Krishna, which led to the discussion of the Kumaras, Lord Brahma and Hamsa, avatar. It was all about this. Subject, object, and relation. And we discussed how difficult it is to separate subject, you know, subjectivity from objectivity. That relation is very problematic. So here, Ramanujacharya, he says, this is what thinking is all about. The thinking or cognition is all about subject, object, and relation. And we discussed at length all of the, you know, logical contradictions that come out of this. And this is basically what philosophy, mental speculation is all about. It's all about studying, you know, what is the subject and what is the object and what is the relationship between the two and where does subject end and where does object begin and so on and so forth. So in any case, the basic point is for there to be thinking, there must be these three things. There must be a thinker, there must be something he thinks about, and there has to be a relation between the two. In other words, a hetu, a cause, a reason why he's thinking about that thing. So, now, what are the aspects of thinking or cognition? So, thinking is basically coming out of observation. There's observation, which is called anubhava here. First we must observe through our senses, particularly the jnanendriyas, which are the portals to the thinking mind, like the eyes or the ears. We have some subject matter which is coming into the mind that we observe, and that stimulates our thinking. So then this observation is divided into two. Actually divided into three, but we're going to talk about two first because the third one is special and pretty much in its own special category. So observation is divided into direct perception, pratyaksha, and inference or anumana. So direct perception means you're seeing a thing like this clock, and you think that the clock says it is now 20 minutes before 5. That's pratyaksha. There's not a lot of, you know, difficult thought processes going on. You're simply seeing and your mind is responding directly to what you're seeing. You see, or you see a color and your mind says that is red or that is blue. You see, so this is direct perception, pratyaksha. Then there's inference, anuman. Anuman then is referring to the Prabhupada sometimes says mental speculation. And so then this anuman has two departments. And as I said, this one here is almost an entity unto itself. So we're mainly talking about this one, logic, tarka. So as an example of that, so you're sitting in your room with the door closed and you hear a voice outside calling your name. So you think you recognize the voice. You see, the voice is sort of muffled because it's out in the hall, but you think you know who this person is. You think it's your friend or something. You see? So this is an example of anuman. There's not the help of direct observation. It's based on something indirect. And so you go to the door and you open the door. Now it might be, yes, it might turn out to be that friend who you're expecting to see because the voice seemed to be of that friend. Or it might be somebody else who's imitating that friend's voice. Or it might be someone else who's got a tape recording of your friend and has just held it up to the door and played a tape. You see, it could be so many things once the door is open. You see. So often what we think about something without benefit of direct perception turns out to be different from what actually is. That's a problem of mental speculation. But that's what logic is to help us to do, is by some dependable method to understand things that are not so directly observable. That's, for example, very evident in police work. You see, the police detectives are called to the scene of a crime. So the crime has already happened. Let's say it's a murder, so there's just a dead body laying there. So whoever killed this person has run off. He's not there to be seen. So now the detectives have to use tarka or logic. That means they have to pick up shreds of evidence on the scene of the crime. They have to go around and ask people, find witnesses. Did you hear something? Did you see something? Did you see someone running out? Or did you... whatever. And then they put together pieces, bits and pieces, bits and pieces, until they start to get some kind of logical picture as to what might have happened. They're still not sure, but they're getting some idea. They sort of narrow down the case. Well, this person might have done it, this or this person or this person, maybe three or four persons, and they become what is called the suspects, you see. So that's when they consider that they're making some headway in the case. All right, we have a few suspects, you see. So then they interview the suspects. They bring them in the interview and they start to talk to them, and they're watching them very and asking them questions and seeing how they react and try to, you know, catch them in a lie. And then I think what Aristotle called perfect inference or perfect induction, that's another word for inference, induction. This perfect logical process is when you get complete confirmation that taking this case of the criminal, the one that the police most suspect, the one that they think did the crime, they narrow it down to one person, and they keep on him, they keep on him, they keep on him. Means they can't, they don't have enough evidence themselves to actually prove that he did it, but they just keep on his case, keep on his case, keep, and then finally he confesses. And that's what the philosopher Aristotle called perfect induction, or perfect inference. Because then when he confesses, then that's external confirmation outside of your own thoughts, your own speculation, that your logic was correct. You see, if he doesn't confess, then you've got your logical case. They try to get it as, you know, as together as they can with as much evidence, and then bring it to court, and then it's argued before lawyers. But you know how these court cases go. It may turn out, it may not turn out. So the best thing is when you can finally get some external confirmation for your logic, but that's not always possible. So anyway, this is inference or anuman, trying to understand things which are not directly observable, or at least not completely directly observable by the process of tarka or logic. And then, very much involved with inference, but yet apart from it, is intuition, divya pratyaksha. I mean, without intuition, there could be no such thing as police work, there could be no such thing as science. So intuition is related to our thoughts, our thought processes, but actually intuition is, well, in a sense, of course, everything is coming from Paramatma, but we, by our false ego, can lay more claim over this area. But intuition is less under our control, you see. So Ramanujacharya, he calls intuition divya pratyaksha. It's divine perception. So the problem is when we're in a not very pure state of consciousness, then our intuition, it might be right, it might be wrong. It's may not be so clear. But in any case, its origin is the Paramatma. And Ramanujacharya does say that by Bhakti Yoga, one develops one's intuition, and ultimately, it's by completely purified intuition that the spiritual senses finally become active. That's the state of completely purified. Divya pratyaksha means divine perception. So we know it at our present stage of consciousness as intuition. You know what I mean? That feeling you get sometimes. Someone is talking to you and you just get this, you can't prove it by logic, but you just get a feeling that this person isn't telling me the truth. There's just something wrong with just the vibration of his words, there's just something wrong here, and I don't think I can believe what this person is telling me. But you have no either observation, direct observation, or even real logic to base that conclusion on, but it's just a feeling, you see. And as I said, in our present state, sometimes the feeling is correct, sometimes it's not correct. Sometimes we have to, later apologize because we had a wrong intuition about someone, you see. We think someone is misleading us when actually this person is really helping us. But Ramanujacharya says that by Bhakti Yoga, intuition is purified. And then it actually becomes the means by which one has direct transcendental perception of the Supreme Absolute Truth, the Personality of Godhead. Divya Pratyaksha, divine perception. So, since we're on the subject of intuition, we'll talk about dreams. Just mentioned dreams, which is of course svapna. So when one is sleeping at night, then this pratyaksha, direct perception, is shut down. And so, yet we're still seeing something in our dreams. So where is that coming from? That's coming from smriti, from memory. And you know that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that memory comes from Him. So actually, dreams are created by the Paramatma. They're created in the mind, they're supplied in the mind by Paramatma. But they are, because smriti, what we observe is recorded by the Paramatma in the spool. Prabhupada called it, it's like a spool of film. So it's recorded by the Paramatma. So therefore, our dreams are very often the replaying of experiences that we've had. Sometimes we'll have a dream of something that happened the same, a few hours earlier that day. Something quite, that made an impression on us. Deep impression on us, then we'll dream about again at night. But sometimes the dreams are, they're not, it's not so clear what we're dreaming of. It's muddled, it's confused, these could even be memories of previous lifetimes that are being brought up by the Paramatma and mixed together with other, so in this way we get this mixing of memories, and in this way dreams become very fantastic. Prabhupada gives the example of, we've had experience of gold, we've had experience of seeing a mountain, the mind and the dream combines them both, and then we see a golden mountain in the dream, so in this way. But one important point Ramanujacharya makes is that sometimes intuition, Divya Pratyaksha, also enters into dreams, and intuition is also being provided by Paramatma. So therefore, there's this phenomenon of, for example, precognitive dreaming. A person will have a dream of something happening before it happens. And I actually know of a case involving a devotee. Not that the devotee had the dream, but it involves the devotee, because his godbrother of mine, whose parents died in 1979, I think, in a terrible airplane crash that happened at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. That was when a Boeing 727 kind with three motors. It's an older kind of jet. I don't know if they fly them still. But anyway, it took off, and then while it was still above the runway, it just flipped over on its back and fell down on the runway and exploded, and everyone was killed. So this devotee, his parents, both of whom were quite famous, they were both quite well-known authors, they died in this crash. And I remember reading about it, because the crash was reported widely in the news, and I remember reading their names, and I knew this devotee quite well, and I knew that these were his parents, so that struck me. And then a little bit later, it was reported that for several weeks before this crash, the authorities at O'Hare Airport had been receiving telephone calls from a man who was telling them, "I keep having a dream every night of a plane with three motors taking off, flipping over on its back and crashing." And the police were sent to interview this person. So it came out later that this was all on record, before the crash actually happened, that this person had been calling in. He was very alarmed. "Why am I having this dream night after night?" And people came to talk to him, and you know, they made records of what he said. It was put in some official... But what could they do? I mean, there was not much they could do about it, except just record that this person is having this dream. It's something that hasn't happened yet, so what can we do? And then suddenly a few weeks later, actually what he visualized in his dream took place. So this is given as an example. This is pretty much accepted. I mean, it's pretty hard to argue against this as an example. And there have been other such examples. So those who are not in favor of things like extrasensory perception, they will just dismiss this as a coincidence or whatever. But it's a pretty strong argument that there are precognitive dreams sometimes. So Ramanujacharya says, these kind of dreams happen when intuition, Divya Pratyaksha, accurate intuition, then bleeds into our dreams, which are... the mind relating with smriti memories, you see. So then Divya Pratyaksha bleeds into the dream, and one can actually have a vision of the future in one's dream. So that pretty much covers thinking. So we'll go over to All right, we'll go over to feeling next. We can cover that quickly. Feeling affectation basically means emotions, and Srila Ramanujacharya says there are healthy emotions and there are unhealthy emotions. So healthy emotions are those emotions which flow in the direction of love, which ultimately must mean love of God. You see? Anything going under the name of love, which puts on the brakes before love of God, then is not really love. That's lust. And that's flowing in the other way, the unhealthy direction. Which, if it's lust, then lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, envy, you see, kam, krodh, lobh, matsarya, mada, these are said to be enemies of the mind. Lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, envy. So they are ill feelings towards the Lord, towards other beings, and ultimately even towards one's own self. One is actually envious of one's own self. That's directly stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's basically what feelings are about. The feeling, on this point of love, like Srila Prabhupada said, the closest thing in the material world to love of God is the love of mother towards child. So this would be an example of healthy, although still material, but it is healthy. It is a healthy state of affairs that a mother loves her child. It's very unhealthy if she hates her child, you see. So it's that would be considered healthy, and a mother is loving her child and is very selfless. She sacrifices herself for the sake of her child. And such mothers are pious. And such mothers can easily become religious mothers also, because of their wanting the best for their children. So now let's go over to willing, conation. So this is about free will, but our free will is minute. Therefore, our willing or our actions, because that's what willing means, the will to act out what we think and what we feel. So, therefore, our willing comes under two categories. Actions that are in accordance with the Lord's supreme will. So that those type of actions, that type of will on our part is liberating. That will liberate us. And that's what Bhagavad Gita is all about. Krishna is telling Arjuna, act, but act for me. And if you act for me, then you will be free from all sinful reactions that Arjuna was so worried about in the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna said, you don't have to worry about them if you act under my protection. However, on the other side, if we act in defiance of the Lord, if we break the precepts that he has set down for activity, then that kind of action breeds reaction or karma. All right, so having explained that, now let us see what bhakti brings to these three functions of psychology. Let us see how bhakti purifies and perfects these three, these thinking, feeling, and willing. So, bhakti brings to cognition or thinking viveka and arjava. Viveka means right discrimination. So, what is right to think about and what is wrong to think about, that is established in bhakti. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, what is that? Think of me, become my devotee. How does the verse go? Man mana, yes. Man mana. So, me, myself, mana. Have myself on your mind. And we know, always think of Krishna, never forget him. This is one of the six principles of surrender to the Lord. So, viveka, right discrimination. So basically that means to think of Krishna, to think of Krishna's name, his form, his qualities, his activities, his instructions, to think of his service, to think of his devotees, to think of the place where devotional service to Krishna is rendered, to keep the mind, to think of the shastras in which the knowledge of Krishna consciousness is given, to think of the instructions of our spiritual master who is speaking on Krishna's behalf. So to keep the mind thus fixed. This is viveka, this is right discrimination. And whatever is contrary to all of that, that is to be rejected. So that's, in essence, viveka, right discrimination. And then arjavam means honesty. So, wrong philosophy, like atheistic materialism, Mayavad philosophy, voidism, any type of wrong philosophy, Prabhupada would always point out that it is attractive to those who are not honest. This is again and again pointed out. That those who are dishonest, those who, for some reason or other, do not want to surrender to Krishna, do not want to engage in devotional service, who want to cling to a materialistic conception of life, who want basically to gratify their senses in this material world, who want to be animalistic, want to be totally nonsense, want to be, in other words, criminals, dishonest rascals, then it all starts with dishonest thought processes, you see. Like the Mayavadis are very fond of word juggling, you see. You can catch them again and again and again, tie them up in their arguments, but they'll try to slip out. They just cannot submit. They'll just try by juggling words to slip out so that they can have their so-called freedom and independence. So they can do whatever they want to do, which is ultimately gratify their senses. So the nature of Bhakti Yoga is that it rids the mind of this dishonesty and establishes honest, clear thinking, and what follows from that is honest behavior. So therefore we'll go over here to the willing side. So here Bhakti Yoga brings three things. Kriya. Kriya means regulated activities. Just like we get up early in the morning, we follow a regulated schedule. Then abhyasa. Abhyasa, like Krishna says in Gita, abhyasa yoga yuktina. So abhyasa specifically refers to those activities beyond merely regulated activities, which are also important because regulated activities will establish us in the mode of goodness. But beyond that, the abhyasa activities are those which specifically items of service to Krishna, and they link us to Krishna. And then there's dana. This is in relationship to other living entities. Dana means um, Well, welfare activity. So, like in the Sankirtan movement, when we simply go out and have Harinam Sankirtan out on the street, that is the greatest welfare activity. That is also abhyasa, that is also kriya too. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has, this is the Sankirtan movement, and he stresses that as much as possible we should be engaged in Sankirtan. So that is our main kriya, our main activity of sacrifice. It is abhyasa, our main item of devotional service, of satisfying the Lord. And it is also the main dana, the main welfare activity that will benefit all living entities. So at one stroke, Sankirtan, the Sankirtan process is these three at once. And then what does Bhakti Yoga bring to our emotional life? So instead of ill feelings towards the Lord, it brings longing for the Lord. Longing for the Lord. As we see expressed in the Shikshashtakam prayers, Govinda Virahena Me Viraha Bhakti. This is the mood of longing for. Longing means I have not attained Him. I have not attained Him. Viraha means separation. Vipralamba. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said, this is higher than Sambhog. Sambhog means to be with Krishna, to be together with Krishna. Of course, that is also very nice. But even higher than that is this feeling that I have not attained His lotus feet, and to be longing for them. Why is that higher? Because Srila Prabhupada explained, then Krishna enters the heart of the devotee in a very special form called Bhavarup. Bhavarup is His form as the emotions of separation, and that is even more ecstatic, more concentrated bliss, more experience of the essence of Krishna than to be directly in His presence. And that is of course fully exhibited by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in His Mahabhava ecstasies. So longing for the Lord. And then as far as towards other beings, there's Kalyana. Kalyana means well-wishing. One wishes only the best for other living entities. Daya, mercy, compassion, mercy towards other living entities. And Ahimsa, one does not want to do any harm to other living entities. And Srila Prabhupada says, defines real Ahimsa as ultimately meaning preaching. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, that if one is really to be non-violent to others, to do no violence to others, one must be preaching to others. Because not to preach to others, just to, one may, you know, be all right in one's own activities, but if he's just sitting by watching all the other living entities in the world go to hell and he doesn't do anything about it, then indirectly this is himsa, this is doing violence. You see? Just like if you see a child playing in the street, cars are whizzing by, and there's a child running after a ball, balls rolling into the street, you see this child running into the street, and there's a car coming, and you think, well, it's not my kid. You know? And then you walk away and you hear the child getting hit by the car. Well, if there was a witness to this, you would be liable to arrest and prosecution. You see, you could be arrested by the police. Because this person was there, he could have reached out and pulled the child back, but he just ignored the child and walked on, and the child was hit by a car. You see. So this is the full meaning of ahimsa, non-violence, is to engage in preaching. And then towards one's own self, anavasada means joyfulness. Bhakti yoga brings joy. So one feels the happiness of being a pure spirit soul, eternal servitor of Krishna. One is not depressed. Actually, Srila Prabhupada once said, he said that the feelings of depression or moroseness, that is a clear sign of Maya, because the soul is always in the soul in his own glory, his own glorious condition, is always blissful. So one who is practicing bhakti yoga then will experience this anavasara, this bliss of being an enlivened, enlightened devotee of Krishna. So getting that, now we talked about dreams, svapna, as being the mind's interaction with smriti, with memory, and also sometimes, well, we can say always with intuition. Intuition is always involved, actually. Intuition is always there, involved with our, how much intuition plays in our daily thoughts. It's very much a part of it. And yet intuition is a separate thing, because it's more coming, it's coming from Paramatma. It's a gift. Ramanujacharya calls it Divya Pratyaksha, and Madhvacharya calls it Shakshi, the inner witness. But the Paramatma is the inner witness, and giving us intimations of what is really going on. So the more, and Prabhupada says, the perfection of Krishna consciousness has come to the point of taking dictation from the super soul. One is getting clear and accurate information from the Paramatma by way of purified intuition and being completely guided by the Lord from within. So getting back to dreams. So in dreams also there is still this subject-object relation going on to some extent. But in deep sleep, I've tried to show down here, this is supposed to be an explosion. Subject-object relation, it all gets blown apart. There's no more subject-object relation in deep sleep. Susupti is, or deep sleep state, is a suspension, a total suspension of cognition and also conation or willing, thinking and willing. But it is not a suspension of feeling. Therefore, again, bhakti yoga is the supreme yoga system, because even in deep sleep, feeling goes on. And how do we know that? Because after one has slept deeply, soundly, and we wake up, we very often say, oh yes, I slept well. That much we don't remember anything. We didn't have any dreams, but we remember the feeling of it. That it was a very nice sleep. I was very tired. I'd done a lot of service, but I was able to take rest early, and I got a good night's sleep, and I woke up feeling very refreshed. You see? So there is a feeling of deep sleep. So even here, some emotional sense remains. So as already explained, the dreams, svapna, is experienced by the linga shabira, the subtle body. The willing, of course, is going on in the stula sharira, the gross body. And the deep sleep is taking place in the karana deha. The karana deha is the causal body, which is the root. It's the root of the subtle body, or the basement of the subtle body. It's the false ego conception in avyakta, in non-manifestation. And Ramanujacharya explains that when this karana deha, this causal body, through purification by yoga, which involves the suspension of the sense activities and also the thinking, in mystic trance. So when the Karana Deha is purified by Siddha, by mystic perfection, then one can achieve Yogi Pratyaksha, the perceptions of yogis. And yesterday, we showed you that chart where you saw the Janaloka, Tapaloka, Satyaloka. So those are where the yogis are. The Siddha yogis, the perfected yogis, you know, there's the Siddhas and the Charanas, they're born with the eight mystic powers into these planets. So they're naturally endowed with the yoga Siddhas. At the same time, their consciousness is fixed, again as I explained yesterday, on the Karana. Karana means cause. So these are the Brahmavadis. The Brahmavadis means the seekers of Brahman, which can mean different things, like Atri Muni. He had some idea that there is a Brahman, there is a Supreme Lord, but he wasn't sure, is it Brahma, Vishnu or Shiva? You see? So he wanted to have a son born by the Supreme Lord. So because he wasn't sure, all three personalities appeared. And so he had his son Dattatreya, who was a combined form of Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva. Dattatreya is still widely worshipped in South India. So this is the beginning of this Karana conception. One may think that the cause is Brahma or Shiva or impersonal Brahman or Vishnu. And so then when that concentration is combined with Yoga Siddha, then one gains the yogic powers. But Ramanujacharya says for the devotees, what the devotees attain by bhakti is nirupadi plus jnana. Nirupadi means they are rid of all designations. So this is a designation, gross physical body. This is a designation, linga sharira, subtle body, and even this is a designation, karana deha. This is the first designation of the conditioned soul coming into the material world, residing within the body of Karana Dakshay Vishnu, Lord Mahavishnu, and then being breathed out. Srila Prabhupada writes in the third canto of souls who follow Brahma, these same mystic yogis, they follow Brahma at the time of devastation, even Brahmaloka is consumed, but they follow Brahma to Mahavishnu, and they then take shelter of Mahavishnu, and since Mahavishnu Loka is the gateway to Vaikuntha, it's conceivable that they could pass beyond Mahavishnu Loka and enter Vaikuntha Loka. But they have this little hang-up. Prabhupada explains in the purport, citing Madhvacharya, that they're attached to their former big positions in the highest regions of the universes, universes, because these are yogis coming from many different universes. And so in these different universes, they were in Brahmaloka or Janaloka, and they were being respected there as great sages, great rishis, Brahma rishis, Maharishis, and so on and so forth. And so because of that little touch, even though one might say, well, that's very exalted. I mean, you know, they want to be great souls, but that becomes the karana, the cause, for their going back into the material world when Mahavishnu breathes out again. Instead of going to Vaikuntha, they just assemble around Mahavishnu and they offer him prayers, waiting patiently for him to breathe out, give out his next breath, and then very happily they enter back into the universes and again become a Lord Brahma or one of the Kumaras or some other, you know, great rishi or sage or something. And then Prabhupada notes that this is the actual fall down of the living entity. It's the second time around. The first time around, in other words, the first time around, the living entity may have come into the universe, or let's put it this way, the Lord may take it that, all right, my dear little living entity, you have some attraction to my lila of creation of the universe. So, okay, you can be involved in this. You can be Brahma. And as Brahma, you'll be my devotee, and you'll be perfectly situated in Vedic knowledge, and you'll see all of my avatars when I come, and I'll never let you down. Even when you're baffled by the four Kumaras, you just remember me, and I'll appear as Hamsa avatar, and you know, I'll always be there for you. So then the little jiva soul says, all right, sounds like a good idea. So then he goes into the universe and he spends one whole lifetime as Brahma, because Brahma lives for as long as the universe exists. And in 9th canto purport, Srila Prabhupada says that's actually the first birth that every living entity took when they entered into the material world as Brahma. So then as Brahma, when the universe is wound up, Brahma goes back to Mahavishnu. So fine, now you can go back to Vaikuntha. But the little jiva thinks, well, you know, I had it pretty good there. I mean, I have my own universe and my own, this wonderful lotus flower I was sitting on. The demigods were coming to me, offering me prayers, and I had so much fun creating every new day of, you know, living entities, and boy, I was practically like God myself. I mean, it was a lot of fun. I don't know if I want to go back and just be a servant again. So then, in this one purport, Srila Prabhupada said, that is the actual fall down of the living entity. He goes for twosies. The Lord sees this desire in him and says, all right, well, that's what you want. And then this means he goes back now attached. He's attached to him, to actually attached, more attached to Maya than he is to Krishna, and then he'll get entangled, and then birth after birth after birth after birth after birth after birth. So, yes, that was all in connection with Karna also being a designation. This is also a designation. To think of oneself as Brahma, that would be an example of a Karna Deha designation. So, Nirupadi, Sarvupadi Vinirmuktam, Narada Muni says. One has to become rid of all upadis, all designations. Shtula sharira, gross body, linga sharira, subtle body, in which we have our thoughts, our imaginings, our visualizations, and even the karna, the root false ego. All of that has to go. So nirupadi plus jnana plus transcendental knowledge, which means knowledge of one's actual swarup, actual form as an eternal servant of Krishna, then this one will bring one to the Turiya stage. The Turiya stage means above the modes of nature entirely, because this Yoga Pradyaksha stage, the stage of the yogis, there's still a touch of the modes of nature. Therefore, the yogis, they have a tendency to become agitated, to curse, to use their mystic powers in a spectacular way to impress others that I am God, I am all powerful. You see, like Durvasa Muni, he's the best example. He's such a powerful yogi that he's considered an expansion of Lord Shiva. He's so powerful. But as we famously know from the ninth canto, even he got himself in a lot of trouble and was chased all over the universe and even into Vaikuntha by the Lord Sudarshan Chakra for offending Maharaj Ambarish. Because he was thinking, I'm a great yogi, I'm so accomplished, and who is this Ambarish, this Grihastha, Kshatriya, I'm a Brahmana, Sannyasi, he's a Grihastha Kshatriya, and who is he to break his fast before me? So, therefore, he created this fire demon. But the fire demon was driven off by Sudarshana Chakra, and who then began to chase Durvasa Muni here, there, and everywhere. So this yoga pratyaksha stage is still not free, particularly of this ahamkara, this tamoguna, in the form of ahamkara, which again means the karana deha. So the Turiya stage means above the modes of nature, completely vishuddha sattva, pure goodness, and it's in that state, vasudev sattva, that one experiences one's pure relationship and pure devotional service with the Supreme Lord. So that is the outline of the system of Bhakti Yoga psychology, which is an explanation of that quotation, the full quotation, filling out the indications of that quotation from Srila Prabhupada, in which Srila Prabhupada said that the by devotional service, the devotee becomes free of all designation. That's exactly what Prabhupada said. He becomes free of all material designation and goes back home, back to Godhead, and achieves his original spiritual identity there. So this begins by applying bhakti in our present affairs of thinking, feeling, and willing. So we have a few minutes left. Are there any questions? Yes.
When we are conditioned for the mode of goodness, according to this, what exactly conditioning in the mode of goodness when we are influenced by the mode of goodness? Because this again upadi.
This what?
This again upadi. We again are thinking that we are in body.
Yeah. But the mode of goodness should be engaged in the service of the Lord. The mode of goodness is, the Bhagavatam says, that there are these three qualitative modes, and of them, one, the sattva guna, is useful because it is the energy of Vishnu, who is the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if one rises to the mode of goodness and in that state engages in the service of the Lord, which is actually what the material mode of goodness is supposed to permit us to do, it's facilitating. The material mode of goodness is there to facilitate devotional service. You can compare the material mode of goodness to an airport, you see. So you come from Bulgaria, so there's the Sofia airport. And you want to fly to India so that you can come to Mayapur Dham, the holy Dham of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So fine. Therefore you go to the airport. But you go to the airport with your plane ticket And you have to make sure that you get on the plane, the right plane at the right time, you see, so that the plane will take you here. If you go to the airport, well, maybe Sophie Airport's not such a good example, but if we take something like Heathrow Airport in London, which is practically like a city, you see, or Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, one of these big, big metropolitan airports, LAX in Los Angeles, or Kennedy Airport in New York. These airports are like cities, and they have, you know, they have hotels, they have restaurants, they have cinemas, they have all kinds of shops, they have, you know, everything there, and so a person can go to one of these airports. He has his ticket, but suppose he gets enamored. Oh, there's this movie playing in the airport cinema. I haven't seen this yet. Oh, I really have to see this movie. So he goes in there and starts to watch the cinema, and he forgets about time. And his plane takes off, and then he comes out of the cinema happy. I watched that movie, but you missed your plane. You see? So what was the point of your coming to the airport then? You see? So this is the whole point of the mode of goodness, is to give us facility to get on the plane. In other words, to engage in devotional service. And if we don't do that and just enjoy the material facilities of the sattva guna, then we are going to become dragged back by rajoguna, tamoguna. They'll pull us back down. So therefore, Narada Muni, in explaining all this, he says, there's one simple method. He explains that one should go from tamoguna to rajoguna, then rajoguna to sattvaguna, then sattvaguna to vishuddha sattvaguna, then one should go back home, back to Godhead. But he said, there is one simple method to accomplish all of this, and this is that one should be a faithful disciple of one's spiritual master, worship one's spiritual master, follow his instructions, and you know, make sure all of his activities are approved by his Gurudev. And in this way, all of that is accomplished in one stroke. So if you do that, then you don't have to worry about becoming a victim of the material mode of goodness. You see, it's only when we deviate from Guru, Shastra, Sadhu that we have these worries about the influences of the modes of material nature, or the planets, or any other thing. Just like someone was raising a question to Srila Prabhupada that, I'm worried because in my astrological chart there's something, Rahu is, you know, that inauspicious planet is playing a major role now. And Prabhupada just laughed and he said, with one kick, Srila Prabhupada can kick out 10,000 Rahus. Just one kick with his lotus feet, he can kick away 10,000 Rahus. So what are you worried about? So if we're at the lotus feet of Krishna, which means to be at the lotus feet of Guru, Shastra, Sadhu, you see, fixed up in devotional service, there's no worry for these things. There's only worry when we deviate. Anything else? All right, yes?
I have something just about when we started the seminar, I remember, I think it was in the first lecture, you explained that, if I understand correctly, sattva-guna is like a positive side of our mind, because we see everything very nice, very positive and so on. But actually we can see that the world is, like Bhagavad Gita is saying, the world is poor and misery. So sattva guna is again a type of maya. Is it proper understanding?
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. What I was explaining, if I would look at my notes, I know it's in my notes, and my notes say that the mind is the energy of Lord Aniruddha, and that energy is the sattva guna, and the sattva guna is a real energy. So that is the original nature of the mind. It is sattvic. It is in the mode of goodness. Now, by misuse of the mind and the senses, we can corrupt our mind so that it becomes polluted by rajogun, tamogun. But the original nature of the mind is sattvic. And Prabhupada then said, if we engage the mind in the service of Lord Aniruddha, then our mind will be transformed into Krishna consciousness. So that's what I said. And I know that's what I'll find in my notes. Huh? What you're saying, what you're doing, I know that I won't find that in my notes, so I don't know where you got that from. Alright, so tomorrow we're going to go further into, basically now what we have presented to you at this point is the Bhagavad picture of the mind. I mean, today and in the days, recent days previous. And tomorrow we're going to go into some further details, particularly talk about some potential problems that we face with these minds and how to deal with them in devotional service. We're going to also go on into talk a little bit about types of minds, because that's also there in the Vedas, that it's called personality typology. There are different types of, just like we know, that's what Varnashram Dharma is all about. That there's Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras. So these are four types of human beings, four types of basic types of personalities. But actually, there, when you, we'll look at Ayurveda, where you get up, I think, up to 26 types, and there are other forms of typology. So we'll just look at these things. It's interesting. So that's what we'll be doing in the next couple of days. Kind of just filling out the picture, the broad picture already established, bringing it into clearer and clearer focus. And then at the end, we're going to talk about modernity, the condition of the modern world, and how that's so inauspicious for our psychology, and that's actually the cause of everyone's problems in the world today, including devotees too, is the nature of things in the modern world, which amount to a state of insanity. The world, therefore Prabhupada, a long, long time ago, in the early days of ISKCON, he published this pamphlet called Who is Crazy? So the material world is simply crazy. And here we are, you know, the Hare Krishna movement is still, relatively speaking, compared to the rest of the world, a very small group of persons. And we are trying to become sane in this vast ocean of insanity. So naturally, we can expect to face obstacles. So we will try to analyze, try to go into this problematic area and analyze what the basic difficulties are that we are faced with in the modern world. All right then. So
So we'll see you all. Thank you for coming. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.